Bonjour, bienvenue à tous. Je suis désolée que nous puissions parler en français et je vous remercie pour l'invitation et pour écouter en anglais. So, thank you. My name is Soshin. I haven't met some of you, and I come from the United States. I moved here a little over a year ago from Western Massachusetts, and I got my training in New York City at a large training temple called the Village Zendo. And the Village Zendo is in the same general line of Zen as White Flower. So this is the first session I've done here, and there's a lot that's really the same. So it's very familiar. And there's also things that are different, but mostly I've been appreciating the things that are the same. And I think for me, what stands out as just really important is the quality of the practice here and the sincerity of the practice here and the fact that we can go to a very deep place of silence and concentration together in a way without stress, without a lot of drama, just being able to sit, practice, and just appreciate what we have here and appreciate our lives. Today, when we were doing Kinhin, somebody opened the windows and it was like this fresh air came in for this very closed space we've been in the last 2 days, and I could hear birds singing. And smell the sounds, the moisture of the earth, and it's so precious. So this is a Tuesday. It's our day three of practice. It can often feel difficult for many people. For me, certainly, my body often has a hard time with the extended sitting, and my back aches and my leg aches and when I have things going on in my mind, stresses, they start to come out. And this is like this high point of the session where all of that starts to bubble up, At the same time, it's also the point in the session where we're settling in and we're really going deep and we're entering silence, even though it often doesn't feel like we're entering silence, right? The mind is going, and yet at the same time, we're in a place of kind of quiet. Those two things are happening at the same time. So I'm really grateful to be here with all of you doing this today. Now, I guess the other point I want to make about that though is, when we're here, it's helpful to remember why we're here, even when we don't necessarily even know why we're here. Like, I know I sometimes have this question come up for me. It's like, it's hard, my back is aching, I'm not having fun. What am I doing here, right? Why did I do this? And yet, every single one of us came here with a question, with something we're trying to understand, resolve about our life. And sometimes the questions are along the lines of, how can I just feel more relaxed and at ease in the world? Or how can I like work out all this stuff with relationships that aren't going well, or with my job, or things that are just can be really messy in our lives. And sometimes those questions are some more, so I would say, spiritual, for lack of a better word. But, you know, what is the meaning of life? Like, what am I doing? Why am I on this earth doing all this stuff? Like, what's it all about? And in fact, those are often the same questions, right? How do I bring harmony into my relationships is not a different question than how do I get meaning, or how do I understand why I'm here? You know. So those are the things that bring us here. And those questions, you know, change over time. If we've been practicing a long time, the question that brought us here originally might not be the same question that we have right now, but they're always sort of these related questions. And it's helpful, I find, to go back to that question when we're sitting and just like, what is it? What is it? What's this about? So I'll tell you a story that happened to me before coming. As I said, I moved to France about a year and a half ago, and I have a little house. It's in a small village in the south. It's very, very dry territory. I have a little bit of garden. And last year at this time, I was very busy with dealing with things at the house and other issues, and I didn't have any chance to really get outside into the garden. And the garden had been badly neglected. Okay, so there's like some things that were growing, but not a lot. And when I went to try and like dig, the ground is so hard. Like I couldn't even break through. Okay, it just felt like dirt and clay and stone, and it wasn't fun, and I couldn't even get very many holes. So I gave it up for a little bit and lived with it this last year. And then this year, as you probably know, it has rained pretty much every day of February. And so the ground is now flooded. And I thought, maybe it's different, right? It's a different year. Maybe the earth is different. And sure enough, like, you can dig, and it's a pleasure. And so it's like, oh, I can turn this garden into something I'm going to really like. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go out right now. I don't know what that is, but I'm going to dig lots of holes so that when I figure out what I'm going to plant in them, the holes will be ready. And so I'm digging, and there's lots of weeds, and I'm pulling them out, and there's long tap roots, and it's just like incredible. And what I notice, though, is I'm not actually having a good time. Like, I feel a kind of stress. So it's like, this is strange. Like, I'm out here doing what I want. The sun is shining at this particular moment. Why do I feel like a kind of anxiety or a stress happening in me? And what I realized is that I had set up this idea of this garden, this beautiful garden, and that had overwhelmed my experience of actually gardening, right? And so I had this goal of, even if it wasn't perfectly formulated, of where what was going to go where, but I had this thing I wanted to achieve, and then I was feeling stress at trying to achieve it. So Amy introduced in her first talk sort of the concept of koans. And for those of you that weren't here, koans are basically teaching stories, and they're kind of paradoxical, not very linear conversations, typically between a student and a teacher. And most of the koan collections are looking at stories from the Tang Dynasty in China. Okay, so they're quite old, 800 AD. So there's a koan that sort of addresses this issue that I was just talking about, and it's called Ordinary Mind, okay, is the way. And so in this koan, the student who is from the Japanese version, his name is Joshu, but he's Chinese. His name is Chao Chu. is talking his teacher. The Japanese is Nansen and the Chinese is Nanyuan. And he says, what is the Tao, or what is the way? And that's basically your question. Whatever your question is, how can I feel more at ease? What am I doing? How do I make my sitting easier? How do I achieve enlightenment? All of that is combined into this question, what is the way? And the teacher says, ordinary mind is the way. Well, so what does that mean? Okay, like, is that my mind that's going off like a monkey, you know, constantly chattering to itself? Is that the mind that's fussing, complaining, angry, frustrated, like all those things I don't like about my mind? Is it that mind? Or is it my good mind where I'm being kind and compassionate? What does he mean by ordinary mind? So ordinary mind was an expression that was developed by a prior teacher named Mazu. And what he meant by ordinary mind was that mind, which is actually the sort of ground of our being, okay? We don't know, have a good way of translating that, but maybe you could translate it as our Buddha nature. Maybe you could translate it as the mind ground. Maybe you could translate it as like something pervasive that's in us, okay? But that's what he's referring to when he says ordinary mind is the way. Well, so that's not a mind that we necessarily feel like we inhabit all the time, right? Like that seems like a big deal to say, I'm calling it ordinary mind, but how do I get that? And so Chaozhu says, then should we direct ourselves to it or not? In other words, is this my new goal? Okay, before I wanted to know, my goal was I wanted to get the Tao, I wanted to get the way. Now, am I saying, okay, well, now my goal is actually this ordinary mind? And Nanyuan says, if you direct yourself towards it, you move away from it. Okay. So as soon as we set up this thing out there that's something separate from ourselves, this thing we're trying to attain, we're farther away. We're not any closer to it at all. So then Zhou Xu asked the sort of logical, Zhou Xu asked the logical question. He says, well, if we don't try, how can we know it's the way, right? Like if we don't put in effort and bring out our energy to manifest something, how do we know what we're doing? And how can we even say we're practicing? And I think, you know, that really is sort of the checking question for us, because it's easy for ourselves to fool ourselves that, you know, we're practicing, but we're falling into old habits or old ways of thinking. And so we need to have some way of knowing whether we're actually on the way or not. But again, there we've separated from it, right? We're not living it. We're not on the way. We need to be on the way. We don't feel like we're part of the way. What do we do? And the teacher says, well, the way does not belong to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is illusion. Not knowing is blankness. So that's very true, but what do we make of that? How do we live with that in our life, okay?
Could you repeat that?
I repeat that last thing? Yes, yep. He says, so Nanyuan says, the way does not belong to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is illusion. Not knowing is blankness. Sorry, what?
Blankness.
Blankness. It's translated different ways, but blankness, delusion.
Almost blindness would be.
And so I find this a hard practice point, okay? And one of the explanations for how we can think about this and work with this is given by Uchiyama Roshi, and he was a very influential Zen master in the 20th century and wrote some excellent books. And he talks about this problem of setting up a goal or a target that then becomes like another thing that oppresses us and where we experience that separation in our practice. And he's talking very specifically about what we're doing when we're in Zazen, okay? So we have this idea when we're sitting in Zazen that we are going to achieve this one-pointed mind, and we are going to be able to focus like this, and our mind, everything will drop down and will be something. I don't know, but, you know, we will... Maybe we'll achieve enlightenment, or maybe we'll be one with the universe, or maybe we'll just be quiet, okay? That's what we're doing in Zazen, is we have this idea that then, of course, is not how it is, right? Because I don't think anybody in this room sits for period after period of Zazen and just has that experience, okay? Our mind is constantly... activating. In fact, Uchiyama says that we should think about our mind as another organ in our body that's just secreting thoughts, right? Our pancreas is secreting whatever it secretes, and our glands are secreting their things, and our mouth secretes saliva, and our brain secretes thoughts, right? So it's just doing its job. Okay, so what we want to do, what he suggests, is rather than try and attain this goal of some kind of one-pointed meditation, we want to simply aim. We aim without a target, without a goal. It's just that act of aiming. And we do that with our whole body and mind. And what we'll find when we're aiming is that sometimes our mind is going and we're sort of in an agitated state. And when that happens and we notice that, we just simply bring it back to the aim. Or we may find that we're falling asleep. You know, our mind gets bored. It gets lazy. We even doze off. When that happens, we bring it back. Because our mind is constantly moving back and forth between the active and passive modalities. And our job is simply to aim, right? With our whole body and mind. So I want to talk about this concept looking at something other than just Zazen, okay? Because when we go on a session, we're doing a whole lot of other things besides Zazen, and all of them are our practice. So let's look at Orioki, okay? So we've been talking about Orioki in the last... in Amy's last Dharma talk. And again, I really appreciated that question. It's been delightful food for thought. And there's many different ways to look at this question of like, what am I doing in Oriyoki? Like, am I just trying to shovel down the food? Right? Or am I supposed to starve myself, like not get enough to eat and be hungry all the time? And the thing about that is those are just two not very appealing choices for us, right? We don't like, typically, when we don't have any good solutions for a problem, right? So the solution of eating too fast to be able to enjoy it and to be able to digest it, or the solution of not eating enough so that you can, you know, eat slower, doesn't feel like what we want, right? And we spend, from what I can tell, the vast majority of our time trying to make our world in such a way that we're getting what we want, right? And in fact, everything about our society encourages us to fulfill our desires so we can get what we want, whether it's more consumer goods or whether it's a better body or whether it's a better marriage or whether it's a better whatever it is. And we really resist the idea that, one, we might not get everything we want, or that maybe we don't even want to be trying to get everything we want, that it may be okay to actually not get everything we want. So I want to tell you a true story about this very issue that brings that out. And this took place in my home temple in New York. And just so you know, the Village Zendo, it's a lay temple, okay? There were priests, there are priests, but the practice was lay. It wasn't a residential, facility. And so people had homes, they had jobs, they had marriages, they had children, okay? They were living an ordinary life, even as they were really focusing on a practice. And the practice was kind of first generation American Zen. So those people who are newly inheriting Zen from Japan really were interested in transmitting as much of the Japanese forms as they possibly could. And that was what Amy was talking about yesterday. So now we're later on in this process. We've got the second, third, fourth generation, and people are saying, okay, we've all learned these forms from Japan, but what's actually helpful for me here, okay, in France, in America, 21st century, in these particular conditions? How many of these forms feel meaningful to us right now? That's what transmitted teacher gets to work with. What's most helpful? What do I want to do? So anyway, the Village Zendo was very, really wanted to impart the traditional forms as much as it could. And consequently, we did a lot of Oriyoki, okay? And we had a Zazenkai every month, and every month we had an Oriyoki, and then we had two sessions a year, and Oriyoki at those sessions. So a new practitioner came in, very serious, very disciplined, wonderful man. He's still there. And he happens to be kind of tall and thin, and I think with a very high metabolism. And so he was so dismayed by not being able to get enough to eat and having to eat at that pace where his metabolism could not digest the food properly. And he was just like, this is not right. And so he occasionally mentioned this, and nothing was done about it. And eventually he tried that third choice, and that was the same essential third choice that Amy was talking about when she was saying something about what she was like, I don't like the way the bulls are doing this, and I don't want to do that, right? And so he's like, no. I'm not going to, I need to eat. I have to eat. And so I need to be able to eat all the food I need to eat. And if it takes me longer, I'm going to do it that way. And so he took his time. And he also sat in a chair, I might add. So his taking his time was like really hard for those of us sitting on the floor. And he ate and he chewed. And this went on for a long time. Until he was done, and everybody sat there in zazen with their aching legs, having finished a long time ago, while he eats his food. And this went on for years, okay? And so I don't know what everybody else thought. I imagine that other people had their reactions. But I can tell you, I'll be honest with you, what I thought. This is ridiculous, okay? It's not right. This is not Sangha practice for one person to be hijacking it like this. So I had all kinds of judgments. I was in pain. I don't like being in pain. This was not good. Why doesn't the teacher do something? Somebody should fix this, right? It's not right. And he... Well, I don't know what he went through because I never talked to him about it, but I can only imagine in his position feeling arrogance, okay, which is not a good feeling, okay, but he might have been feeling arrogant. He might have been feeling some shame because he's putting himself out there in a way where he knows that probably many people weren't too happy with him. Maybe some fear. Are they going to kick him out? You know, what's going to happen? I don't know. He must have had lots and lots of feelings come up for him, just as I had over the years, lots and lots of different feelings come up for me. But what courage, actually, if you think about it, to stick with that, right? He went where there is no cold and there is no heat. Let it kill him, okay? He had to go there, and he did. And the teacher let him go there. And then all I can tell you is that one day, it wasn't a problem anymore, okay? I think that he figured out that he could just simply ask the Tenzo to put a little food aside for him and he could eat more later. It wasn't hard. But it was hard until he figured that out. And it was hard for me, and I think for other people, until we could go to that place where there was no cold and no heat. Just let it kill us, be there with us, and go, okay. I'm not getting what I want. It's okay. I feel uncomfortable. It's okay. It's okay. Right. Amy mentioned that wonderful quote by Keats. So I had to look it up so I understood what she was saying in English. In English, it's when man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after facts and reason. Okay, that's the negative capability. Okay, capable of being in those doubts, uncertainties, and mysteries without without irritability, without reaching out, kind of mental construct to solve the problem for ourselves. And I would say that part of that uncertainty and mystery is the ability to tolerate discomfort. I would add that into that, because when we can tolerate that discomfort and our confusion, and we don't understand why we're doing it this way, and we want something to fix it for us, and when we can just be with that without being irritable, without making some kind of logical construction to explain it away for ourselves, that's the practice. So Orioke gives us lots of opportunities to practice with form. And I, I want to just talk about that word for a minute, because we have this idea of form, right? We get these forms from Japan, this form like orioki, or this form like bowing, or all the different forms that we have. And so the question can start to become, what forms do I want? Okay, which forms are we going to do? You know, I was saying, well, the Village Zendo had lots of Japanese forms, and Amy practiced in a practice center that I think had lots of forms. And she said, well, I'm not going to do lots of forms. I'm going to do different forms. There's always form. Okay, we never don't have form. We are in bodies. In fact, that's a mistake. We are bodies. Or it's maybe even better, just bodies. Bodies practice. Bodies have form. So here on Sesshin, you can see we've got sort of two different versions of taking a meal together. So for those that that aren't eating meals, breakfast and lunch, I do the traditional Japanese orioki, which is very involved and involves all these different bowls and bows, and we chant a service and pass the food to one another, and we do all these kind of highly ritualized forms. And then in the evening, we don't take our dinner like that. We would do what I would just call our habit form. So we walk on over to the table, get the food that we want to get, and we wait in line, and we sit down, pull out the chair, we're sitting up. We're in silence, but we eat when we want to eat. We take a little bit of this food, a little bit of that food. If we want more, we get up and go more. That's our habit, normal way of eating, okay? So the wonderful thing about this is we get to experience those two different forms. And we get to say, which one supports our practice? Okay. Maybe they both support our practice, right? When we've been sitting all day and we're really tired, it's really helpful to sit at a table and to have a little bit of ease, because there's a lot of buildup of strain in the practice, body practice of sitting and on the floor orioki. And so having a break can be very welcome. Or we can say, actually, I notice that when I do the Japanese orioki, my mind is really concentrated. And when I do the dinner, my mind starts to wander. And I start to gaze out the window, and I start to think about this and that. And then I can't help myself, and I look over at that person, and I see what she's doing. And I'm back in my non-practice practice. Okay? So there's no right or wrong about this, of course. This is just two. We get to practice with both these forms and see what is it that actually supports me this week while I'm on Sesshin. And so I have a little note here to myself, hard versus easy, right? Because I didn't use those words, but when I was talking about, you know, the practice of tolerating the discomfort, it's really helpful to look at how we really just want things to be easy. Even when we say we like a good challenge, right? Like a good challenge, I like a challenge. But we want to be comfortable, and we want things to be easy. But being comfortable and being easy doesn't bring us to that edge where we can really look at what is this, right? We say, I want to know reality. We don't know reality when we're not at that edge. What is going to bring us to that edge? Now, this changes over time. Like, so this particular koan was is from Chen Chu. And I'm very fond of him. And one of the reasons that I'm fond of him is that he was not a Zen master that did like hitting and shouting, okay? The prevailing practices during his period was like 30 blows, okay? Boom, beat that ego out of you, because that ego is holding on so tight. That habit energy is so difficult to get rid of. And these guys were like incredibly macho, and they resorted to like hitting each other, okay? And if they weren't hitting each other, then they were yelling at each other. The story about Rinzai is that he shouted so loud that one monk went deaf, okay? So that's like an incredible energy, but it's way more energy than I think we really want to practice or that we would find helpful for us. So what is helpful for us? Okay, well, Chao Shu thought that what was helpful was being able to point at what he wanted the person to understand in such a way that their mind could just go, huh? What? Right? And that's what Chao Shu is learning from his teacher in this koan, because his teacher is not giving him direct answers, is not telling him what he's supposed to do, is not shouting at him, is not hitting him, he's pointing in a way that forces him to go outside of logic and reason to kind of know in a very deep way in his body something that he intuits but can't really grasp. So, so the koan goes on, okay? So after Chao Chu says, well, if we don't try, how do we know it is the way? And then Nan Yuan says, the way does not belong to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is illusion, not knowing is blankness. Then he adds a couple of sentences. He says, if you really attain to the way of no doubt, it is like the great void, so vast and boundless. How can there be a right or wrong in the Tao? So let's, yep, I can. If you really attain to the way of no doubt, it is like the great void, so vast and boundless. How can there be a right or wrong in the Tao? So let's look at that. So in Zen, we have an expression, great faith and great doubt, okay? Those are the two capacities that are helpful to us in our practice. You don't understand. We're struggling with a question. We feel separate. We don't feel like we really get it, okay? And we need to have great faith in our capacity to move through that, okay? We need to have faith in the practice. And at the same time, if we just say, ah, it's all going to be okay, thanks, everybody, you know, that's not going to get us any satisfaction either, right? We need to cultivate that doubt. What is it that's going on? What is the way, right? That great doubt. But Nan Yuan is saying here, we need to attain the way of no doubt. So that's a little confusing. But what I would suggest is that we have moments where we feel where the questions dissolve, right? So they don't dissolve forever and ever, right? That's why we keep practicing, because they keep coming back. We keep entering into the world. New issues come up before us. We don't feel resolved. There's a wonderful phrase from Dogen in the Genja Koan. He says, when Dharma fills your whole body and mind, you understand that something is missing. Okay? So there's always this doubt in there somewhere. And yet, at the same time, there's always this doubt. We can also have moments when there's no doubt. No doubt and the doubt can exist simultaneously, like so many other things from a non-dual perspective. It's not this or that. It's both of them. So we need the doubt and we need the no doubt. That no doubt is where we're just digging a hole. We're just filling a bowl. We're just chopping carrots. I've been doing that. You know, we're just here. No doubt. There's no question at that point. It's like the great void. So vast and boundless. And other translations say it's like outer space. Okay. So here we are. Sorry, do you need more time?
Reorganize.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. And so I would say that there's no difference between the great void and digging a hole. Okay. There's no difference between the great void and filling up somebody's Oreo bowl for them. No difference. That's the great void. Okay, that's what fills us. And when we're in that space, there's no right or wrong. Yes. Maybe I put too much food in that person's bowl. Maybe I have too much food in my bowl for me to feel comfortable. But there it is. It's just food in the bowl. Okay. Food in the bowl, water in the bucket is the expression. So I think that's a good place to stop. Are there any questions? Holly.
When I meditate and in my life in general, I have a child who is infantile, who wants whatever she wants when she wants it. And I have a parent who is very demanding and, you know, educating or correcting. It's difficult for me to find a middle way. So that even in the beginning, in these days when I've been meditating, it's normal. Your mind is going. That's normal in the beginning of a long session. It's normal. And then I start to realize that, in fact, I'm just like letting myself go. Like, I'm just allowing, it's another way for me to be an infantile child by just letting it go. I'm not just being open, it's like, really, I'm just like, you know, images, thoughts, go for it, do whatever you want, it's normal. And I know that if I go the opposite way and the parent comes in and gets too controlling, that's not good either. So I'm kind of, I don't know I can't feel in my mind the middle way, the right effort that's not too much effort.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head with Uchiyama's Roshi's instruction, okay? Because we just aim, and we know sometimes we're going to fall in one direction. You could say fall. Our mind is going to go in one direction. It's going to be that loose, anything goes, sleepy perhaps, too much, you know, just not disciplined, okay, that way. Or we're going to head in another way, right? There's all different ways to sort of move along that path. Other way, the strict, controlling mind that doesn't give you room to breathe, okay? And so we just habit, body, and our mind, and we aim. That's all we do. You don't have to know what the way is. Just have to aim.
And whatever happens, happens.
No, well, yes, whatever happens, happens. And then when you notice that you're not aiming anymore, you bring it back.
Je peux parler en français?
Si, oui.
Je pourrais en anglais, mais ce serait très difficile pour moi.
Oui.
Pour illustrer donc tout ce que tu as dit, qui était merveilleux et qui reprenait ce qu'a dit Amy hier, me viennent à l'idée du... j'ai déjà énoncé quelques fois, c'est l'Anyashin-gyo Sutra, que l'on récite que j'ai récité pendant une quinzaine d'années au moins dans la lignée de Deshimaru en France. Et puis, donc, c'était en japonais. Et ça, je pratiquais l'assise, le zazen. Mais je ne comprenais absolument pas pourquoi on devait réciter chaque fin de cérémonie, l'Anyashin-gyo Sutra, tout le monde, pendant 15 ans. Puis après, dans une autre sangha, il y a eu la version japonaise, et puis la version, en fait, pas française, c'était en Espagne, donc c'était en espagnol, mais là je comprenais ce que ça voulait dire. Donc déjà, ça m'a intéressé un peu plus. Et le fait de chanter tous ensemble était effectivement l'harmonie de la sangha. Et donc j'ai commencé à apprécier la récitation de l'Anyashin-gyo en japonais, puis en espagnol, que je comprenais en français. Après, j'ai voulu faire ma propre traduction en français pour moi, pour me le réciter. Je me suis inspiré de nombreuses traductions qui existaient déjà. Et dans le sutra de l'Anyashin-gyo, on récite « Il n'y a pas de bouche, il n'y a pas de son, il n'y a pas d'oreille, il n'y a rien, tout est rien et rien et tout. » Et bon, ça c'est comment dire, ça me parlait. Sauf qu'à la fin du sutra, on récite la petite phrase en sanskrit, Gyate, gyate, para gyate, para sam gyate, bodhiswaha. Et je dis, mais qu'est-ce que ça vient faire en japonais ou en français? Que vient faire cette petite phrase à la fin, qui est le mantra suprême, le mantra merveilleux? Ça aussi, ça me gênait. Je ne comprenais pas pourquoi ça venait, alors qu'il y avait toute une logique avant qui me plaisait. Et là aussi, donc, je me suis efforcé de comprendre les traductions. Enfin, j'ai lu plusieurs traductions de ce gyate, gyate, etc. Et en fait, ça colle exactement à tout ce que tu as exposé ce matin, ma traduction, qui illustre donc tes propos et ma pratique du zen. Ma traduction, c'est aller au-delà, aller au-delà du par-delà, ainsi soit-il.
Yeah, I think I understood what you were saying. And that's, you know, that's a great point. I want to just say that I think that there's a reason that phrase is always left when we're chanting the Heart Sutra, and whether we're chanting it in Japanese or whether we're chanting it in French or English or any other language, that phrase is traditionally left in the Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is because it's not really translatable. Mm-hmm. I mean, we say, gone, 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 gone to the other side, right? But what does that mean, right? And so when we chant it in that Sanskrit, it's this reminder that what I'm talking about today and what Amy talks about, you can't actually say, right? We're talking about things, as soon as we're using words, we break things into duality. And so it's a helpful reminder. There's this energy, gone, whatever that is, gone, right? I don't know what it means. I don't know. Can you speak a little louder? Thank you.
You talk about aiming.
Yep.
There's a degree of trust in that aim.
Mm. Yes.
Otherwise, it's just empty aiming.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we come to practice, we bring our whole self to it. Right? That whole self is complex. It has fears, it has yearnings, it has things it likes, things it doesn't like. And you're bringing up one thing that you bring into it, which is trust. Maybe that's a question for you. How do you trust? How do you know you can trust? For somebody else, it might be, I just feel anxiety when I do that. But something else that they're bringing to it. So it's really helpful that you can name that there's this question for you around trust. And all I can say is, I don't know what your resolution to trust is, but that's a practice point for you. And it's a very deep practice point, because the more you can kind of explore it, the freer you will be. So I think it gets back to, again, what Amy was talking about, is where do we go where there's no cold or heat? Where do we go where there's no fear of trust, where there's no lack of trust, where there is trust? And we get to the place beyond that by entering fully into the place of no cold, no heat. Are we complete? I think so. Okay.
Never. Mm-hmm.